It is Ryan Seacrest here. People always say it's good to unwind, but that's easier said than done. The exception, Chumba Casino. They actually make it easier done than said, or at least the same. Chumba Casino is an online social casino with hundreds of casino-style games like slots and blackjack. Play for fun. Play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Sign up now and collect your free welcome bonus at chumbacasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.
Enjoy this cool and short listicle provided by Dr. Arthur Vosloo from his book, Magic and Mysticism, based on philosopher Hans Jonas's existentialist depiction of Gnosticism. Here it is. 1. A hostile cosmos, Gnostic antipathy to nature. 2. A demiurge, or ignorant creator responsible for botched creation and hostile to human spiritual awakening. 3. Dualism, opposition between the realm of light and the realm of matter. 4. An elaborate mythology. 5. Myths concerning Sophia, wisdom, and her fall and restoration. 6. Belief in a hidden god, not the demiurge. 7. Difficulty of spiritual progress due to the archons or other hostile powers in the cosmos. Ignorance of the inherent fallen human condition. 8. Existence of the Ogdoad, or 8 spheres, including 7 planetary spheres, and possibility of their transcendence. 9. The necessity of gnosis, or direct spiritual knowledge from the realm of light. 10. A revealer or redeemer figure to show the way to the realm of light.
Valentinus believed the world we live in was created by a cruel god, and slightly stupid. A god that will send you plagues, or require sacrifices, or destroy Babylon.
He wasn't wrong about that. The bastard had a mean temper.
Humans can escape this world, and return to the real one. The kingdom. And for that, you needed to achieve the Gnosis, which could be described as true knowledge.
Hello, everybody. Happy Heresis. Yes, Gnosis, the true knowledge that will get you back to the kingdom. Or there's an old saying that I have almost forgot about it, but it was Giles Gispel, Jung's henchman, if you would, who simply said Gnosis is the knowledge of the heart. And I used to think it was too new agey for me, but now I realize it makes sense, especially in a world that does not make sense, in this Philip K. Dick world, these Gnostic times, and this age of Hermes. We are transitioning into a new era, and only the trickster will get us there if we want some semblance of our sanity to survive. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your Pompidus of Gnosis, and I welcome you. Welcome you, everybody showing up in the chat room. Welcome, regardless of what medium or platform you are listening to. Reality bites, and the aeons bite back here. And today, I'm very excited for this show because it's always good to talk awesome shop about occultism, magic, and Gnosticism, but it's good to get some useful advice on, yes, on how to save some semblance of our sanity. So with us to do this, I'm very excited to have Nathan Duby. Nathan, thank you very much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan. I've been following you guys for a few years, and I'm very much honored to be here.
Pleasure's all ours. And with us too, we've got the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing? Are you still crazy as a fox?
Oh, yeah. I'm the Moondog of Gnosis. And I'm going to love this because I always like practical things. You know, people can do spiritual things all day long, but it's good to bring it down to, I mean, we're here for a reason, right? We're here. So we may as well get some practical use from our practices and our Gnosis.
Yeah, making it to the end of the day is hard for anybody. It takes a certain skill and strength just to get through your job, family, whatever's coming down the pipe, go to bed. It's not easy. It's not easy, as they say. So, yes.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I see people coming into the chat. I see Mr. Anon Omos, who goes by Asterox Foundation, on the chat. Good to see you. Good to see some other of the usual suspects. And as always, if you have any questions or complaints against Vance or me, please super chat them, and we will definitely get to them. Not much in the housekeeping. Again, next show will be Christopher McIntosh, a traditional podcast, who will discuss occult Germany. You'll be surprised, because it's not going to be about our favorite German occultist, but much more than that. And next week, very excited, we'll be doing a show on Harry Potter and alchemy. And then Neil Gnostic Informant will be joining AM Byte. He's got some amazing scholarship he wants to share with the world. Later on, we hope to get Chris Knowles, because his new book, Synchromysticism, is out. And it's a banger. It's a game changer, as really anything Chris puts out. And yeah, a lot of great shows. Gary Lachman will be joining us later in the month to discuss a little Gurdjieff. Speaking of useful gnosis, so we don't all turn to robots and become food for the moon. So please support, like, subscribe, share with your friends, support in any way you can. Buying the tarot, one-time donations. You can join the Patreon for as little as $1 a month, because I know in these times many of you are monetarily challenged, like I am and most of the middle class and lower class is, because the Archons are taking us for a ride on their heavy metal. Well, let's get to the interesting stuff. So, Nathan, tell us a little bit about your story and how you came to become a heretic.
Well, I was raised as a Christian. I, quote unquote, got saved at the age of 5. Was raised in various different Protestant denominations, primarily. Attended a few Baptist churches, several evangelical. Had some run-ins with Lutherans. And then on the flip side of the coin, my grandmother was a Catholic, so I've attended Mass on a few occasions. And, you know, Christianity was presented to me in a spirit of love. My parents, to this day, are still devout Protestants. But by the age of 12, I remember I was at a friend's house drawing. It's a random sketch. And I drew my interpretation of heaven and hell. So at the top, you know, heaven, at the bottom, hell, and sort of a middle area, if you will. And I completed it. And upon looking at it, I said to myself, I don't believe this. And instantly I got a pang of, you know, fear and terror, because that's a no-no. You shouldn't be saying those things or questioning those things. But I continued to question. By the time I got into high school, I started, you know, meeting friends from different walks of life, atheists, no religion, different religions. And I discovered cannabis, which fortunately, thankfully, here in Massachusetts is totally legal now. And that really opened my mind to start to ask a lot of questions. You know, it's funny, I bring up Christianity. Yeah, you know, as a Christian child, like many, I was introduced to the idea that Santa Claus is this, you know, magical hobo who lives in the North Pole, who brings presents to all the good children once a year. And I remembered at 8 years old when I found out it was a lie. It really bummed me out, because I was really into the whole idea of that. It was very magical, for lack of a better term. And, you know, it kind of made me think, what else am I being lied to about? And so when I was 15 and I discovered cannabis and realized what an incredible plant it was, you know, the medical possibilities of it, you know, not just for recreation, but doing research about Rick Simpson oil and him being chased out of the country after creating a concentrate that helped him cure his own cancer, I really started going on a journey of questioning things. And, you know, moving on from there into my 20s, I would say I was around maybe 2021 where I discovered Hermeticism. When I was 15, I read quite a few books about world religion. I would skip class. I was a rebellious hellion for sure. But I would often stay on the school grounds and sneak into the library. They had a small section of books on world religions. So I was studying Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, different variants of Christianity. And, you know, from that point, moving into my early 20s, that's when I discovered Hermeticism. And, you know, at that stage in my life, coming from conservative Christianity, it was, you know, it felt like, oh, this is a no-no, I'm being bad. But what I, how I justified it to myself was, well, you know, if you're going to fight the enemy, you have to know your enemy. So I came at it from that perspective. But the deeper I went into the concepts of Hermeticism and perennial wisdom and philosophy, you know, it really started to continue to chip away at the facade that began falling apart when I was 12 years old and I drew that picture being my interpretation of heaven and hell.
Awesome. And you also were editor for Disinfo, right?
Yeah, I want to say it was circa 2016 to 2018, give or take a year. After discovering the work of Grant Morrison and his famous rant or speech, whatever you want to call it, at the DisinfoCon back, and I want to say it was 2000, I was just so blown away by his intensity and his authenticity and, you know, just how he was projecting that magic, you know, works. And it had such a profound effect on his own creativity and developing the incredible stories and, you know, hypersigils within the Invisibles. At that time, when I started writing, again, 2016, give or take, the website had been in sharp decline for quite some time. They started covering a lot of topics outside of what made the website famous, what made it big. And I reached out to the then editor-in-chief, a gentleman named Thad McCracken, really great chaos magician, very interesting, eccentric fellow, fellow writer, guitar player. And, you know, I did some sigil shoals and shot my shot. And he said, sure, we'll bring you on board. Ideally, we'd like you to, you know, focus on, you know, the occult community, because we want to build back this website to at least some specter of its original intent and glory, if possible. And so I spent a couple of days thinking about it. And that's when I said, well, I think the best way to do this, because I had connected with so many magicians, occultists, seekers, alternative spiritualists online, would be to do an interview series where I ask people essentially the same set of questions so that you can compare from one interview to the next. And it was primarily magicians, but there was some, you know, deep thinkers and psychonauts, including yourself, Mitch Horowitz, Chris Knowles. So it wasn't exclusively magicians, but the vast majority included people like Jake Stratton Kent, Jason Miller, Rufus Opus, Sarah Maestros. And much to my joy, every single one of these people said yes, and I was able to interview them. And that's kind of how I got involved with Disinfo before it kind of fell apart towards the end of 2018.
Yeah, I remember, God, even in the mid-90s, I used to go to Barnes & Noble to buy the Disinfo book or whatever, whenever it came out, and it was... it was edgy, but it was intense. But I understood it served a certain section of society, the shadow, the experimental, the wild. So it was really cool, and I'm glad it was part of my whatever my 20s. But yeah, nothing lasts forever, as they say, and you just leave that magic there. So that's interesting too, because I think when we're talking about Grant Morrison, to help me understand religion, even the religion I grew up, the religions out there, I just, tell me if you agree, one day you realize that magic, religion, and art are all the same thing. They're all cosplaying, they're all trying to create an aesthetic, and they're all really trying to manipulate reality in a subtle way when doing it right. So do you agree with that, and did that help you again, how it's just we're all just pretending. We're all cosplaying into some sort of new form.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, art is magic is art. It's a quote from Tommy Kelly from Adventures in Woo Woo. And I absolutely believe that. To say that religion is cosplay, I think, is a great metaphor for it. And that's certainly what it feels like. You know, I think it was Thomas Jefferson who famously said that the Bible is a smoking dung heap with jewels, gemstones of wisdom throughout. The purpose of the book is to dig through the shit, extract the truth, and leave the rest views behind. And to say that, you know, I was disappointed with the cosplays that I saw within Christianity, which there were supposed to be no divisions, but in Protestantism alone, I mean, there was over 40 denominations that I became aware of. And then Catholicism. And it's only recently that I've even dug into the Orthodox. So to see, you know, the vast divisions within the belief system, it's absolutely true to say that everyone is cosplaying their own version of it. And each version is sometimes strikingly different from the next.
For sure. For sure. I mean, I keep thinking of the song, no confession, no religion, don't believe in modern love. So I think the other one too, that helped is with me is the, when you really start understanding mythology, that opens a whole new dimension and everything sort of falls into place. And it's even bigger than religion, because then you're going up into the world of the archetypes, into the one. So you realize, wow, this universe really is wonderful. It's not just heaven, hell, bad God, religions and all that. I remember even when I was young, my mom was pretty well rounded Catholic. I would look at the Hebrew Bible and like, oh my God, what is this flood and talking snakes and this all happened, Mom? And she was like, oh no, these are just the myths of ancient people. And as a kid, I was like, well, screw reality. I want these myths. This is where the fun is. This is where the gold is. And of course you read fantasy, Joseph Campbell, Star Wars, and it just makes sense. So I would say, too, you would say myth is also very important. But oh, before we get into you, Vance, I noticed too, you're talking about yesterday, Richard Weber talked about Santa Claus, and you mentioned that today. So you think Santa Claus is an egregore?
Totally. Yeah, you know, so I laid that out in the chat. Definitely, because it's real, because everybody gets the presents, right? But if they're lucky enough to have parents that imbibe in the Santa egregore, yeah, composed of all the parents that have loving kindness in their hearts and want to give gifts to their children. And it's just kind of self-perpetuates, you know?
Makes sense indeed. Yeah. Again, that's the other formula. You add in egregores and it really helps out. I mean, and what did Philip K. Dick, a reality is anything that's still there even after you stop believing in it. So, well, Santa Claus is there as an egregore, regardless if you meet him.
I kept getting presents after I stopped believing in Santa Claus.
There you go. So it's reality.
He's real. Oh, and Anon says, bring on Krampus. I don't know. Krampus is not as strong an egregore, though.
No, he needs more belief. More belief from Western culture, and he'll get there.
Yeah. Of course, a little part of Santa was kind of a Krampus because he'd bring you coal, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like a little bit of touch of hell, right? It's the fuel for hell, coal, right?
That is true. That is true. Yes, yes. Ah, modern love. So what do you think of myth? How did myth help you, Nathan? Or how does it work? Is that one of the salves to the healing and understanding of our new world with our red pill suppositories?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've seen The Matrix and the terrible sequels that have gems of truth and wisdom in the piles of shit. But at the age of 11 for summer reading, I was introduced to The Hobbit. And the only time I think I ever really enjoyed summer reading, I mean, I've read To Kill a Mockingbird and some of the other books, which weren't bad, but nothing that really excited me. But The Hobbit absolutely made me a lifelong fan of Tolkien. I actually was just reading The Silmarillion earlier today. I have a special hardbound, green hardbound leather special edition with 24 karat gold inlay on it. So, I would honestly say that, Lord of the Rings is borderline sacred. And Star Wars, absolutely, you know, fantasy, science fiction, and you know, fiction in general is extremely powerful because it is a salve, as you said. It's absolutely good medicine, although it can be used, you know, on the inverse of that. You know, the archons obviously are working quite strikingly through that as well. Just as an offshoot, I watched the American interpretation of that British TV show that I think came out in the 70s original called Utopia. And that show literally made me sick to my stomach. It had the opposite effect of what maybe Joseph Campbell was talking about in The Power of Myth. It wasn't empowering at all. It sort of felt like I was being gaslighted. But on the light side of that thing, the power of characters like Aragorn or Gandalf or Bilbo Baggins or Anakin Skywalker had quite a profound effect on me. His descent into Darth Vader. And I'm so happy today that he, you know, in the Ahsoka series, he's kind of come full circle in that. And I'm not going to make any spoilers. But of all the characters, I would say Anakin probably had one of the most profound effects on my life because I want to say it was 17 or 18 when I first saw the prequels. They were already on TV at the time. And watching the third film, Revenge of the Sith, it really moved me deeply in a way that was both inspiring and a little terrifying because, you know, I was in the process of deconverting from Christianity. And so I really identified with Anakin and sort of his distaste for the Jedi and what he had been put through, which I think absolutely contributes to him going to the dark side. So it was sort of a mirroring experience for me that was certainly very intense. And also, you know, I would question, you know, am I making the right decision? Is walking away from Christianity the right thing? You know, perhaps I'm making a mistake here. Although fortunately, due to other events in my life, it absolutely was. And then, you know, later on to come full circle, you know, I left Christianity because there was just so much wrong with it. The loving God that you see in the figure of Christ compared to the monster of the Old Testament. When you read the entire Old Testament for yourself, which many of my Christian friends never even had when I was a full believer, you know, you get all those uncomfortable verses that you really see his true light. It didn't make any sense for Yahweh to be a precursor to Yeshua. But then discovering Gnosticism, originally when I was 15, but I didn't understand it. It was about 2 years ago. I reread all the Gnostic Gospels and it clicked. And it was like, you know, this makes absolute sense. And it's a much better descriptor. It's a much better explanation for this strange world we live in that is so beautiful and filled with such incredible things like creativity and love, but has these stark contrast with, you know, industrialization, the destruction of the earth, you know, modern day slavery. So yeah, myth has certainly played a very big part in my life and has helped me to kind of take a look at the light in the dark.
Yeah, well, why don't we talk about how Gnosticism might have helped you? Obviously, yeah, those are the two. There's two esoteric, like, Jesus avenues, I guess. Well, there's more. There's Gnosticism. You can go Rudolf Steiner and his Christ consciousness ideas. Obviously, A Course in Miracles. There's a few, you know, might say softer, esoteric, mystic Christianity, although Gnosticism is not soft. It's in more many ways more hardcore than the Old Testament once you really get into the nitty-gritty with the archons and so forth. But how did the Gnostic Jesus work for you or help you out versus the Jesus of the Orthodox Jesus?
Well, you know, in Orthodoxy and let's say traditional Christianity, I was able to see, you know, the beauty of the person of Yeshua, of Christ, whatever you want to call him. And it does, you know, shine through. There are those small gemstones of wisdom and truth in the refuse. I think I was 15 or between 15 and 17 when I first read a few academic articles about Gnosticism, and I was intrigued by it, particularly the Gospel of Thomas. But I just didn't get it. I didn't fully understand the idea of the demiurge. I didn't understand the aeons, Barbelo, and some of the more, you know, technical aspects to it. And, you know, traditional Christianity, absolutely, you know, it gave me a very intense fear of hell, which I actually have dealt with in three separate Dark Nights of the Soul. The most recent one began in January of 2023. I lost my job at the time, and one of my best friends died unexpectedly. And I had kind of put a lot of the introspective spiritual stuff, like, because I dug real deep from a very young age, being, you know, saved at five, and then, you know, learning about world religions and, you know, different philosophies and whatnot. And so from five to, you know, 25, I really spent a lot of time in that. And once I had gotten to the age of 26 or 27, I formally left Christianity, and you know, initially it was fantastic. Then it became very challenging because I lost an aspect of myself, and you know, you do question if you made the right decision or not. But I did ultimately, you know, heal and just feel this huge weight lifted from my shoulders. But I kind of stopped progress at that point for a while, and I had buried a lot of, you know, trauma from the doctrine of hell and, you know, deaths of friends and loved ones that I had gone through over the years. And I didn't properly process those things. And as anybody knows who's gone through trauma, if you bury all that stuff and try to cover it up with alcohol or drugs or whatever distraction, it's going to come back and bite you. And that was certainly an aspect of it. But in 2023, I woke up one morning and I had this, I don't know if I was dreaming of hell, but I woke up and I was just thinking of hell. And I think this was in part spurned by my friend passing and also anxiety brought on from losing my job. And so I got into a pretty dark headspace for a while. And I was like, why is this happening? You know, I've been through these spiritual transformations. I don't believe these things anymore. This isn't even an issue, but it was, you know, it was gnawing at me very, very deeply. And I got a ping or a download, if you will, from the Most High, the, you know, the unknowable, unnameable God, as the Gnostics sometimes refer to him, to pick up the Tao Te Ching. And I read it for probably the 20th time and found instant peace and relaxation in it. And I started listening to an audiobook of it every night for about 2 weeks, and that really helped. At the same time, I was walking 5 to 7 miles a day, because the last time I had a really good friend pass away, it was in my mid to early 20s, I want to say, and I dealt with it by drinking alcohol, and that became a very big problem. This time around, I said, I'm not going to do that. So I, you know, jumped into exercise, again, 5 to 7 miles a day. And starting to do that after reading the Tao Te Ching and listening to it every night, I was Googling something about the Tao Te Ching, and the first article that came up said the surprising links between Gnosticism, Gnostic Christianity, and the Tao Te Ching. I don't remember exactly what that article was about, but that just reading that was like, yeah, you know what? I'm resonating with that. I'm feeling that. That was the next step. Like, okay, here's the next step, the direction you need to go. So I read a couple different articles about parallels between the two philosophies, but that really set me back on the path of digging deep into Gnosticism again. I read all the Gnostic Gospels, Thunder Perfect Mind. The only thing I don't think I've gone through fully is the Pistis Sophia and the Bruce Codex. But
don't worry about that.
I've dipped my toes in the water, and that's you know, that's for another year, perhaps
another lifetime.
But this time around, it was like, I don't know if it was because of everything that I had gone through, or my age, or maybe from working in corporate America and having a very intense research capabilities, which came out from working in marketing and sales, which definitely helped me to become a good researcher. I read it all. I read a lot of peer-reviewed academic research papers, and it clicked. And I was reading the Gospel of Thomas while simultaneously having another article open. And it was it highlighted in bold, the world was created by an evil idiot God. And to me, it was like, why did I not understand this when I was 15? Or I must have missed that, because it just absolutely was like that literally explains everything. And when you dig into the Gnostic Gospels, my favorite are probably Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Mary Magdalene, and the Apocryphon of John. And one of my favorites in the Gospel of Thomas being, you know, seek and you shall find. When you find, you will be disturbed. And when you are disturbed, you will become astounded. And when you become astounded, you will rule over all. Now, I had read that when I was 15, but I didn't understand it at all. Having read it all again, it totally clicked. And I, you know, it's hard to put this all into words, but I had a very instantaneous but complicated download of understanding from what I believe to be, you know, the creator, the true creative force behind creation. And it all just sunk in. It made so much sense to me. It, you know, the personhood of Christ made sense. The idea that each of us contain the divine spark that is a small spark of that great flame that is, you know, the creator. And we are living in this shitty photocopy of essentially paradise or the pleroma It just, it all clicked the second time around and was very freeing in many ways.
That's very inspirational. Thanks for sharing. Sorry for your loss. And I know it's hard. I have a lot to say. I wanted to back up. Yeah. You were talking about, again, Anakin. I think George Lucas' genius was he tapped into Joseph Campbell, who was a Jungian, but he was using shadow healing or shadow work in Star Wars before it was even really known by the major popular. Today, obviously, now shadow work is huge, but again, you see that in Star Wars and you see the healing. And New Agers, it's not easy. I mean, look what, you know, Darth Vader didn't come out of his shadow until he got out. And even as Jung said, Satan is just a God's shadow. Hell is just the shadow of heaven. Simple as that. The Demiurge is the shadow of Sophia. Some say Sophia is the shadow of the plural, but it's this wonderful game of healing that if you play with it and you ride those emotions, ride that information, ride that myth, eventually it will happen. And so true on the trauma, Nathan, as Gabor Mate said, trauma is pain that will not heal. It doesn't care about time. It's more powerful than Cronus or Saturn. You can't crush it with alcohol or sex or success or money, or you can't forget it, and it just keeps growing until it turns into a shadow, your own Hulk or monster or whatever, and it will destroy you. But as Jung would say, it also, or as when studying with Tika, with Paul Levy, your trauma also holds your salvation, because your trauma is information. It's part of you that wants to talk to you and needs you to talk and has valuable information. If this universe is made of information, information will save us. All information will save us. Your depression, your trauma. And it's hard to listen, like you're saying. It's so hard. If we don't listen right, the pain just gets unbearable. But we have to listen. And in your story, I could relate to, because like you, when I was young, alcohol and drugs, that was how I listened, and it just killed me. But when my brother died and I was just clean and sober, maybe a few months or something like that, I also, something clicked. I said, well, I can go drugs and alcohol that way, or I can try something different. And I did what you did. Not only did I read, but I call it the Forrest Gump therapy. I would just walk all day long. I would walk until I couldn't think. I would walk until my body couldn't handle it. I was like, I am going to walk, and either I'm going to feel calm or I'm going to die. And I would just walk, walk, walk. And then suddenly at some point in the day, I was like, I feel better. But you know what happened is suddenly I was listening. I was quiet. My ego was a little bit more. And suddenly the pain of my brother leaving me and how it destroyed my life through drugs, it was better, and it got better, and I just kept doing it. So yeah. Very inspirational. And I think, I don't know else what to say. Let me know what you think.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. I mean, coming up in the church and having the dichotomy of good and evil presented the way it is, you know, the idea that we have a dark side and that it's actually important for us to experience and integrate it is very against, like, at least for me, you know, all Christian teachings. Like if you were to go to just your average, you know, Pentecostal church and be like, you know, you really got to go into that side of you that, you know, wants to do horrible things, or is like, you know, I maybe I'll just become a full-blown alcoholic and I don't care, because why does anything matter? And much worse things, which we see playing out in the world, and war and murder and rape and, you know, slavery is something that's going on in the world. And that's because, you know, I think we are collectively going through a dark night of the soul right now as a species. In fact, I was going to a Jungian psychotherapist and doing analysis that helped me immensely. For anyone who's watching this and maybe has done therapy and hasn't quite had breakthroughs, the process of having your dreams analyzed and artwork that is created under the auspice of very specific instructions related to your subconscious, very healing. And it certainly helped me. And that goes back to this whole thing about, you know, characters like Darth Vader, you know, George Lucas, I believe, said at one point that, you know, Anakin was the chosen one, but Darth Vader is part of that. If he had never become Darth Vader, he never would have killed the Emperor and therefore never would have actually been the chosen one. And that's a hard pill for people to swallow whose view of good and evil is that, well, there's God and there's Satan, or there's A and there's B. You know,
well, look at Lord of the Rings. Frodo chickened out at the end. It
exactly.
was evil who got rid of the, it was the, his shadow, Gollum, who threw the ring and destroyed Sauron. So even Tolkien was like, no, this is how the world really works.
Yeah. And I mean, it even says in the canonical gospels, or maybe it's the Old Testament, that, you know, God created both good and evil and it all comes from him. Maybe that's a little right. bit of truth, because that, you know, when you sit down and think about it, the all, the great, you know, the one true God of love, whatever you want to call it, all of this is serving a purpose. And it's very hard to accept that when you go through something like, you know, maybe you have a niece or a nephew who's murdered, or, you know, right. you know, someone you care deeply about is, you know, attacked and raped or something like that. Like, trauma is not fun. And I wish that it didn't have to be that way. But I will say, having gone through trauma and looking through the lens of so many different religions and then also science fiction and fantasy, there are those little gemstones of truth and wisdom that you collect, you know, leaving the refuse behind. And as you put all this together, you realize that both good and evil do ultimately come from the same place. And they're working, maybe not together. It's like they are in a battle, but the battle itself between good and evil is progressively rising us towards ascension. At least that's how I look at it. I know some people may or may not agree with that, but I can say that going through really dark times in my life, suffering with addiction, getting clean from it, meeting other people who are going through it, darkness can be used in an emotional, alchemical way, and it can be used to transmute negative emotions into positive and bad habits into good. And without those experiences, I can honestly say that I wouldn't be who I am today. And without them, I don't think I would, you know, be as close to the light or have had these incredible experiences with the all.
Well said. Vince, do you have a question or a comment on this very engaging discussion?
Not so far. Just reading the news here.
Did the nuclear war start?
No, not yet.
Not yet. All right. We can finish this interview.
Only my dog's stomach. He came over at 6:30 our time. He wants me to feed him, so, but I can't do it.
Yeah. I fed my dogs before here because I knew how it's going to be. So, but Nathan, let's look at the idea of hell, because God, I'm trying to think, it's been a while before as a kid, I was terrified. And, I don't long before Gnosticism, I stopped being terrified because I was like thinking, wait, do I get a body in hell or is this my soul? And after a billion years, wouldn't I get used to the heat and the pitchfork? You know what I mean? It was actually logic that helped, and then myth, and then later on. So by the time I, you know, started embracing Gnosticism, esoterica, it wasn't even in my head. I mean, and of course, Gnosticism, just like the mystery schools would tell you, is like, haha, joke's on you. You're already in hell. Hell is what you create in your mind. Hell is this world what has a potential for war, natural disasters, and cruelty that even Satan couldn't even devise from human beings, what they do to each other and the lack of empathy of animals and all that. So again, knowing that hell is here and it is sort of you kind of participate in it with your thoughts helped a lot. But what was hell to you as a kid? Obviously, I'm assuming it was just a shadow projection that you hadn't been able to incorporate.
Well, as a child, I mean, you know, the fire and brimstone stuff, much of which, you know, doesn't even really come from the canonical gospels or the Old Testament. It's Dante's Inferno, where we get a lot of the ideology from that. But just a place of eternal suffering. And even as a child, like when I was 11 years old, my grandfather was murdered. That was my first dark night of the soul. And, you know, being a Christian, I kind of felt like, oh, well, you know, everything's going to be okay. He's going to go to heaven and whatnot. Turned out that he was a closeted bisexual, and that sent me into great fear and terror when I found out, which wasn't until my teenage years, because I was thinking like, well, geez, did he repent for that? Because if you don't, you know, the church has a very staunch feeling about the LGBT community. And that definitely put some cracks into, you know, my faith as well. But it also kind of amped up this fear of hell that I began to have as a child. And eventually, you know, the man who killed my grandfather, he learning his story helped me to kind of expedite the process of my first Dark Night of the Soul and just go deep quickly. Because as it turns out, the guy who killed him from a very early age, I think he was like 2 or 3 years old, he had been chained to a bed in his father's basement, and he was basically kept alive with enough food and water and essentially ritually abused until he was 18. The FBI eventually caught wind of this. They freed him. This guy went to a couple years of some sort of facility, and then he was let back out, you know, onto the streets, which says a lot about, you know, the mental health crisis in America and some of the problems we're having. But I'm not saying that understanding this made going through that experience any less hard. But I remember, I think I was about 12 when I had found out that aspect of it. I didn't know about my grandfather's bisexuality then, but hearing this man's story really broke my heart in a way that allowed me to forgive him. And learning the power of forgiveness at an early age, going through such an intensely negative experience, really gave me, you know, valuable skills to navigate, you know, hardships in the future. You know, I've had a lot of friends in my lifetime who struggled with heroin. You know, 6 or 7 of them died within a 10-year period when I was in my early 20s. One of my best friends died in a car accident because he was the passenger in a car, but he got in a car with someone who was hammered. So, you know, I went through a lot of horrible experiences, but these early horrible experiences and the darkness in what I experienced with my grandfather, but being able to find, you know, forgiveness and having that experience helped me to navigate these much deeper experiences. But to go back to the main question, you know, what is hell to you? I guess all of this stuff in a way is sort of an expression of what hell is, which as a child, you think that it's a place of literal eternal torment where horrible stuff like this is just going to happen to you. And it's a punishment because, you know, you didn't live up to God's expectation, but he loves you, however that works out. but to bring that back up to the beginning of 2023, you know, I had not been a Christian for, I don't know, 15 years or however long at that time. So to wake up and have this feeling of like, wow, I'm dealing with the fear of hell. How is this going on? Everything that I just explained sort of educates and kind of builds the basis for my concept of hell. And you had mentioned Jung earlier. When I went to Jungian analysis and psychotherapy, I explained to her, you know, I explained everything that I just did to you, my history, the losses I've had, the good, the bad, being in religion, leaving it, discovering Gnosticism, being a practicing magician. And she said, okay, well, what I want you to do is I want you to paint or draw a picture of hell. And I said, could I do it with like Canva or Adobe because I'm more skilled with doing that? She's like, yeah, however you want to create it. And so she said, all right, so picture yourself in hell when you do this, you know, meditate for a little bit, go to that place. Make me a panel, a drawing in front of you, in back of you, left, right, above, and down. And I'm not going to go too deep into that because it's my own stuff and it's just a long story. But doing that was absolutely insanely healing because by the end of my second session, I had a full and complete, what I can only describe as a miraculous healing of this fear of hell that, you know, after talking to her, I realized was a lot of all the unprocessed trauma that I had gone through that I had suppressed with alcohol or other distractions, which sort of built on the foundation of that fear of hell that I had as a 5-year-old, which never got taken care of either. So by going through this whole process and getting up to this point where I was asked to do this, this exercise, it really goes to show the power of myth, the power of art, the power of cosplaying. And when it's done in the right context, art can literally be an alchemical process that removes the darkness from you while you retain the beauty of the experience that the darkness gave to you.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com. VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Well said, and thanks for sharing. Yeah. What did hell look like? Can you share with that? Or was it stereotypical?
There was definitely some aspects stereotypical. Like, I found a sewer tunnel. For me, sewers, like, to me, hell, you know, fire and brimstone, that's scary in of itself. Filth, there's something about filth that I find very scary. Like Stephen King's It, in both of the films, the clown lived in a sewer. I found that more terrifying than the clown itself. The people in it were obviously in suffering. Some were on fire. Some were, you know, like half rotting bodies. And I actually had a dream that I was at a music festival before I asked to do this assignment. And, you know, this was a dream that my Jungian analyst had asked me about. And I said, I was at a music festival, which as a musician, it's something that I loved. And there was a commotion. I can't exactly remember what it was, but it was like a loud noise, a boom or something. And I was like, what's going on? And the whole tone of it shifted. And there was a girl walking next to me and we had been talking, but all of a sudden her voice sounded like, I don't know, pick an 80s movie where there's demons in it, like that, you know, synth detuned voice. And her response was just evil. And I looked over and half of her face had rotted off. And it was interesting because when I went to do this piece of artwork, I searched abandoned factory in the Canva stock art thing. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that came up was this girl who, I swear to God, it was the same one from my dream. And I wasn't looking for, you know, zombie girls. I was looking for abandoned factories, but it happened to be this artist who took a photo of a girl cosplaying a zombie in an abandoned factory, which is interesting because that was one of, I mean, hundreds of synchronicities that came about in finally getting myself into therapy, which for me, that Jungian psychotherapy and analysis, just, I can't say enough good about it. And if you're the type of person who really resonates deeply with myth, with science fiction, you know, you find religion genuinely interesting. You find these stories so powerful and, you know, you're not a normie, quote unquote. I don't technically like that term because I feel like it can be a little demoralizing. Jung and his approach to the subconscious, if you're that type of person, I mean, it can just do absolutely incredible things for you because it's based on, you know, the shadow and the light play, but it's, you know, the analysis and the therapy is done through the expression of art and dreams.
Well said indeed. Yeah. And we can't forget about complexes, but that's a whole nother shadow is a complex. The ego is a complex. I don't want to complicate things too. And it's interesting because hell is almost like, it's supposed to be actually a good thing that went wrong, because why did people start thinking of a permanent hell? Obviously in Buddhism, Gnosticism, in the left-hand path, there are hell, Bardos, but everything's temporal because our consciousness will always continue to evolve and flow to different worlds and missions and come back. But this idea of a permanent hell made sense because, like you said, this is a shitty earth. Then let's face it, the bad guys win more often than not than the good guys, right? The bad politicians, the dictators, the corrupt CEOs of companies, the people who bully you at school. It always seems like the psychos get away with more. Serial killers don't get caught. So hell is a great place where at least there is justice at the end, right? But then things go off rail because then you're like, well, what's the exact parameters? You know, where's the list? And what if I'm on the list for something I did and forgot and I should have repented, you know, and then suddenly you're falling into a labyrinth. You're like in Hellraiser 2, remember? Leviathan is going through the labyrinth and all. So that's a problem too. Like everything has a shadow side if you don't integrate it. What do you think of that, Nathan?
I totally agree.
Leviathan.
Hellraiser. I never watched horror movies as a kid. Well, I wasn't supposed to. But when I was, you know, sleep over at friends' houses that weren't Christians, I would do it. And then I would immediately regret it. And Hellraiser sticks out. It was one of the most traumatizing movies I've ever seen. But well done. Well done. I'm sorry, I missed I lost my train of thought.
Oh, the idea that hell was actually, it's a way of rationalizing the universe. It is a good thing because ultimately it is about justice.
Yeah, so, ultimately I came to the conclusion that simply doesn't make sense to me in that, because a gentleman, I can't remember what his name, but he says, he was on a talk show talking to a Christian who is, you know, going for hell as being, you know, it makes total sense. It's perfect justice. But temporary sin, temporary bad doings with a permanent eternal punishment makes no sense, because eventually, no matter how bad you were, when you're in a place of eternal torment, you're eventually going to have been tormented to the point that you did to another person or every person or animals or whatever it is. And you cross a threshold where that simply doesn't make any sense. And I could never, you know, I think the reason that I could never really totally jive with the idea of Jesus Christ or Yeshua or his teachings is because it was tainted by this ridiculous antithetical concept of hell. When I was able to, you know, get rid of that, and really that was through reading the Gnostic Gospels and, you know, the inner teachings of Christ, it really made it a lot clearer, you know, what Christ is all about as far as forgiveness. And to go back to what I experienced with, you know, the man who killed my grandfather, the power of forgiveness, and however you get there, whether through its art, whether it's music, whether it's religion, you know, when you get to the understanding that eternal torment is the antithesis of forgiveness, at least for me, that's what really opened my heart to being like, okay, you know, I have a much better grasp on this. And, you know, the Gnostic Jesus, it just makes so much more sense in context of my own experience as a human being. So when you look at Earth as a shitty photocopy, or the universe as a shitty photocopy of the Pleroma, and you think about all of the topics that we've discussed, the darkness and the light and the play all together, which is essentially a process that we're each going through, and now collectively as a species, it seems, it's all being done essentially to get everybody to the same place. At least that's how I feel. That's one of the big downloads that I have gotten when I contemplate these things and I pray and I, you know, speak to God, you know, whether that's in prayer or just walking meditations, what have you. And I think, you know, hell is something that we carry around with us, you know, in Rogue One and Star Wars, Andor, the guardian of the Jedi temple on Jeddah is sitting next to him in prison, and Andor is constantly, you know, beating himself internally about the horrible things he's done in order to fight the Empire. And so he's fighting his own demons and his own darkness, but it's necessary. And the Jedi temple guard turns to him, and, you know, Andor says, I've never been in prison before. Like, I need to get out of here. And he's like, just relax. It's no big deal. We'll get out. He's like, well, I don't think it is. I've never been in prison before. And he looks at him and says, you seem like the type of man who carries your prison around with you. You know,
a prison for your mind, as Morpheus says in The Matrix.
Yeah, exactly. I feel I might have went off on a couple tangents there, but I'm trying to tie together a lot of different threads here, because, you know, when I come on a show like this, or when I'm creating content on my own channel, I'm ultimately trying to provide gemstones of truth and wisdom that I've collected to others, so that hopefully they can add it to their collection and get to where they need to go.
You know what else? If you think about it, suffering, right? If you really think about suffering deeply, we carry around the capacity to suffer because of the vehicles that we're in, you know, the, what do you say? The, I'm missing the term for, there's a certain amount of things, qualia, red, green, blue, pain, right? And if you really decompose it, you know, these are all like keys on a piano of life that we pleasure. And so hell is that collection of black keys, you know, where you hit them in your pain and your suffering and your loss and your, and so that, you know, I don't think I've been following the chat, so I didn't hear absolutely everything, but one of the aspects of hell as advertised by the churches, or a lot of the churches, is the eternal aspect of it. And the reason they did that was to provide a disincentive for people to do bad. Like, if you're not careful, you'll be in hell for 10 years. Ah, no problem. I've done 10 years in prison. It's no problem. Well, then 20 years. Ah, 20 years, no problem. Before you know it, you're absolutely, you'll be there forever. You'll never get out. Ah, you know, they're trying to scare people into being good, into not transgressing. So that's another reason hell became eternal, I think.
That's interesting, because if it actually was, you know, because, you know, there's good and bad people everywhere. Like, just because I've left the church, and I was pretty bitter when I first got out of the religion because it had done a lot of psychological, emotional, and spiritual harm to me. But as I get further away from it, you know, the feeling I'm really trying to cultivate for Christians is compassion and understanding, because when I come across someone now who believes in something that was very harmful to me when I was younger, rather than coming to that from anger, I'm coming to it with, compassion, because I feel bad because they can't see the black iron prison that they're trapped in. You know, They're telling me that, you know, well, if you don't believe, you're going to go to hell for eternity. And it's like, well, you're already there and you can't see that. So, you know, it's important to have compassion for them. But it's interesting, Vance, that you said originally it might have been 10, 20, or 30 years. I do wonder, was the Council of Trent or Nicaea or wherever they said, all right, we're going to make hell eternal, was that really out of, you know, trying to help people to be better? Or was it more of a nefarious Machiavellian plot to separate them from their money? Yeah, probably.
Because, you know, in any organization like that, you've got some people that are nefarious and some people that are well-meaning and misguided and so forth. You know, it's just a mix.
Yeah.
Because you go back to the early church fathers like Origen, who said, you know, if Satan repents, he should go to heaven. Completely logical, right? That's the whole point. Satan repents, he goes to heaven. And as you were talking, Nathan, it makes no sense to torture somebody for eternity. Even somebody like, I don't know, Hitler or Stalin, at some point they would get it. They would, you know, they would say, all right, after a few million years, you know, maybe we were kind of shitheads. Genocide stuff, and we deserve a second chance. And a true loving God is like, all right, you know, Satan, you know, you get a second chance.
Yeah. And that's a hard pill to swallow. I mean,
it is. We all want the bad guys to suffer forever, you know, or the girl who broke our hearts. I hope she has a terrible life. She never finds a guy. And, you know, we want hell for others.
Yeah. And I remember learning about the Holocaust for the first time. And so the Holocaust is something my wife and I talk about a lot, because it's just so mind-blowingly messed up. Like, how could that have possibly even happened? But, you know, the radical forgiveness of Jesus Christ, of Yeshua, that is like, you know, yes. Like, because if I'm sure if he was here right now and you say, hey, if, you know, Stalin or Hitler was to, you know, actually experience all the pain that they put every single one of those people through and their hearts truly changed, do they get to go to heaven? And I think Jesus would absolutely say yes. And I think that's just a shock to anyone's system. And, you know, going back to the whole hell thing, that is like hell is a projection of the dark side of humanity, because we do want people to suffer until it's us realizing, oh no, there's a tiny little bit of Stalin in me, or there's a tiny little bit of this thing that I project my shadow at that I just absolutely want to see destroyed, until you walk into an experience where all of a sudden you see yourself mirrored in it. And then it's like, well, back up.
It reminds me, there's a show called Preacher based on a comic book, and the first two seasons are great and then it really just drops off. But in that show, the creator's version of hell is, when you go to hell, you get to relive the worst day of your life over and over again. And that's extremely torturous. And then they make it, Hitler was like, he was in a cafe and he met a woman and he was so in love and he had his art and everything was going fine. And then some, I don't know, Jewish socialist came out and, you know, made a mess. And the girl was like, ugh, and the girl left him and his art was destroyed. And he was like, so filled with rage, and that, and over ago, he's got to live that. So it's an interesting take. Of course, in the show, I think Hitler somehow escapes hell and goes to be a waiter. But then he's like, ah, screw it. He starts for looking for fascists to take over the 21st century. So it didn't work. And the show, I think some of the best show out there is not just Star Wars, but one of the best shows is Andor, because that show, I think, shows you something far more evil than Darth Vader and Emperor Palpatine: bureaucracy, paperwork, pencil pushers, the banality of evil, of how these people in the Empire are trying to keep their jobs, and you got to go through all this paperwork for anything, and building the Death Star is just bureaucratic hell where you got to get slave labor under the table, and it's far more evil and destructive than anything, again, Palpatine or Darth Vader can do. It's fascinating because it's truly scary and closer to what we have today.
And in a way,
or the movie,
like,
Brazil, you know,
it's more like Brazil than Star Wars. Yes,
fly falls in the teletype, right? Tuttle versus Tuttle.
Yeah, and you really, when you in Andor, when you see the Empire, you see really, you know, it is devoid of love and compassion. Every person in the Empire is trying to step on their own teammates. You know, there are no friends, you know, and it's the
interesting
thing.
Or just keep their job at any cost. I just want my job, my salary.
Just keep the machine running. And
I'm not going to do any better or tell on you. I just want my job, you know?
Yeah. And that's true. Like, that is a hell in and of itself. And a lot of the people, you know, who live in situations like that, whether fictionally or in the real world, you know, the military industrial complex or, you know, the various corporations of that is a literal hell. And a lot of people are living there and don't even realize that they are part of such a system, which is pretty terrifying in and of itself.
It shows like millions of people and robots and androids and everybody's just miserable and complaining. And like you said, it's this, the Empire is like the Soviet Union, but worse, devoid of soul, nihilistic, unhappy. And nobody likes being there. Let's put it that way. It's again, scary. It's like, I'd rather have Darth Vader cut off my head and be done with it.
Right. Yeah.
Hell is for children. Well, that's what Pat Benatar said. So, moving on to maybe something a little less. No, I don't want to move on. Let's, something else I needed to ask you. You're talking about helpful ways for that have worked for you. What are other modalities that you use to keep yourself keeping on the inner journey instead of, you know, going outside, the drugs, the ego, all that other stuff that will, that's out there in the hell that is this world?
Yeah, I mean, art has always been a big part of my life. I do digital art, sometimes professionally, sometimes just for the love of it. I've been working as a marketing and sales professional for 17 or 18 years now. I'm in between careers right now, and I've been focusing more on passion projects. But writing and recording music, writing books, visual art of various types, reading, and I guess something that we haven't touched upon yet, magic. I find magic to be a very empowering practice. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, I try to help people just take the first step, and whether that's creating a sigil and doing a shoal, a la Gordon's work, or, you know, something as simple as a candle spell or something like that. And, you know, the question always comes up, well, is it real or is it all just in your head? Lon Milo Duquette famously said in his book, Low Magic, of course, it's all in your head. You just don't realize how big your head is. And
Vance has words for that too, I know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, do I agree with that or do I disagree with that? It's hard to say, because when doing magic, which is absolutely a form of art, there are times where it feels like it's 100% psychological. But even in those times, I often get unexpected results, which was what I wanted, in a way that I didn't expect or sometimes wanted it to manifest. Other times, you know, particularly if working like a grimoire, like Rufus Opus has a book called The Seven Spheres. It was based on the work of Johann Stratonius. He was a Catholic bishop who supposedly created the system, although academic research coming out now and really learned people in the occult community are saying he never actually created that system. And it was made by Franz Barden, which, you know, in his book, The Magus, was sort of the first one to propagate that idea. Regardless, you know, in that book, you're working with planetary energies and archangels. And, you know, I can't deny that there has been times where I do truly feel like magical work or even music or art has initiated something in the spirit realm, which I often tend to look at as equal to or directly parallel to the collective unconscious. You know, kind of like spirit realm, collective unconscious, or maybe they're the same thing. I don't want to get too far off on a tangent, but I guess the reason I do magic is, one, it's fun. Two, it can be very empowering. And three, at least for me, it doesn't really matter if it's spirit-based, if it's information-based, if it's psychological. And, you know, as Jake Stratton Kent said, you know, you can read books for years, but if you're just going to be an armchair magician, you're never going to know if it's real or not, or if it's right or wrong for you. And just get out there and do it. And, you know, you might burn your fingers, but just like any other great art or extreme sport, you know, mountain biking, if you really want to do something, you got to take the risks. And there will be times where you might, you know, break a leg.
But how would you define magic again? Because it's the old saying that Christians say, we practice religion, you practice magic. Or I forgot, Robert Connor wrote, magic is religion for the individual and religion is magic for the masses.
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, I've honestly, I'm sure this will be offensive to some people, but when I started doing chaos magic back in, I think, 2010, and I also got into Jason Miller's strategic sorcery course, which was great. But my long-term definition is magic is complete and utter 100% bullshit that works. And that is meant to be read with the same spirit as a Zen koan. I'm not extremely learned in Buddhism, but you know, the Zen koan or koan, however you pronounce it, it's, you know, it's a poem that is supposed to be read and interpreted in a way that is, you know, not surface level. You know, and then there's Aleister Crowley's definition, and there's so many definitions for magic. I don't like to get too caught up in that. Like, you know, I was a very technical person when I first got involved because I was like, well, if this is real and it works, then it has to be, you know, it's all going to line up and you pop the hood and you see the carburetor and that connects to this. And you know, once I started actually doing magic and getting results, I was just like, I really don't care. You know, I'm just trying to better my life and I'm hopefully going to inspire people to better their lives. And I've had some uncanny synchronicities and for lack of a better term, blessings that have manifested. Apparently, you know, it appears to me in my experience as byproducts of the magic I've done. Maybe there's a cross section there. Maybe that was an answer to my prayer, someone else's. Maybe there are spiritual forces, both good or evil, that are, you know, I'm wrapped up in their fate as they are wrapped up in mine. It's, you know, it's hard to tell because when you talk about magic and the spirit realm and the subconscious and the collective unconscious, all this stuff can get very wrapped up and very complicated. But for me, magic has been extremely empowering. It's a rebellious act, you know, in a world that is continually going in the direction of what feels like a totalitarian march towards nuclear warfare. It's the, you know, it's the daisy that's growing out of the crack and the concrete that reminds you that hope is potentially more powerful than a nuclear warhead.
Well said indeed. Yeah, you said magic is bullshit that doesn't work. Isn't that marketing too?
No, I said
Coca-Cola, McDonald's.
Magic is 100% complete and utter bullshit that works.
Well, same with marketing.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. Like I wrote a book called Chaocentric Marketing and the Sorcery of Sales. And it's literally saying like, you know, here's everything I learned about sales and marketing, the mundane shit that, you know, you learn if you put yourself through the hell of, you know, becoming a salesperson and then rising through the corporate ladder. And then these very interesting, you know, kind of parallels and magic that are also very effective. And hey, if you blend them all together, you can have a lot of fun in an industry that might otherwise suck your soul right out.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Awesome. But any questions or remark, Vance?
Well, no questions in the chat at this point. I would say for sure, you know, my idea of magic is mentality to physicality. In other words, you're trying to create an effect in the physical world. And that includes other people's minds, because other people's minds then reflect out into the physical world. So an indirect thing. Advertising on Madison Avenue is full of wizards, isn't it? Mm. You know, look at the, in fact, the whole entertainment industry, you know, streaming, television, and so forth, totally supported by advertising, which is what, you know, I mean, do people really look at all these ads? Do people really buy things because they've seen them on TV? I don't. Do you guys buy things? Oh, look, it's on TV. I'll buy it. But mostly the most awful garbage is advertised on TV, and yet they pay millions of dollars. Why? Because they're not paying the companies that make these products aren't paying them. They're taking it out of our pockets. It's kind of a sleight of hand trick. They take the money out of the people that are buying their products, and they fund the entertainment industry. That's magic. That's sleight of hand.
So look at the Federal Reserve and the banking system.
Oh,
the complete illusion, system. And it sustains an entire society.
Yep.
Our economy, it's all, even though it's all nothing, mentaling
them, just... from mental to physical, right? So
there's
that,
definitely
that covers a lot of ground.
Yeah, I think particularly in darker aspects of magic, black magic, and you know, magic that is done with evil intent, I think sleight of hand and deception is a big part of it. I don't think it's entirely that. Working for the light or the dark side, there is an aspect of sleight of hand even to quote unquote real magic, magick, that, you know, it's almost like you're kind of cherry picking an aspect of stage magic, and that's part of the process. But there is also the collective unconscious, the spirit realm, and the mind, how that all translates to change in physical reality. You know, I'm not a mechanic. I just drive the car and I can go fast. is how I kind of look at it. I mean, you can certainly dig deep into various aspects. You know, for example, you guys recently had Sarah Maestros on your channel. Absolutely incredible practicing witch. Her mind is just fantastic. Her work is incredibly academic in its own right, and she's, you know, when she wrote a book recently about the pentacles from the books of Solomon, and if you read that book and you dig down, like, she knows exactly how the car runs. She can remove a single part and it won't run. She can tweak it and it'll go 125 miles an hour when it's only supposed to drive 60. So there's certainly, you know, there is deeper explanations to this, but particularly in the occult world, you put six magicians in a room and the chances of them agreeing about anything is slim to none, particularly if it's a chat room on Facebook.
I have a theory about magicians, which is there's all sorts of magic in the world, but there's so many different cross intentions that they mostly all cancel each other out.
I'm sure there's a lot of that going on. Because just like in sales, like ask any sales guys, have you closed every sale that you've ever gone on? And it doesn't matter if you're the greatest salesman in the world, they'll laugh at you. And just like with every magician, like if I've never come across a magician who's been like, yep, every single one of my spells has always worked and I've always got what I've wanted exactly the way I've wanted it. If anybody sells that, they're lying to you or trying to sell you something or both. It's interesting you say that, Vance, because the deeper I get into it and kind of try to work it out, it becomes very easy to see that all of these forces are colliding, whether it's the massive force of, you know, the darker minds behind modern advertising for something like, you know, toxic food or various other things that, you know, aren't terribly good for the human animal, but billions of dollars is made in it, or something as mundane as, hey, I'd really like to sell my house, or, you know, I'd like to get front row tickets to this. And I guess a big part of successful magic, and I think Gordon's talked about this to some extent a few times in the past, is to go after the things that the probability rate is pretty high on a success level anyway, and throw enchantments at those things. Because I can say that in my own experience, looking for those little things that are already a higher percentage probability tend to seem to happen with enchantment more so than, you know, trying to win the lottery or anything kind of ludicrously big like that. But if you stack a lot of little probabilities that are leading up to a larger probability, you can actually make some of those things happen.
I've got a little spell that I use in traffic. You guys are going to laugh, but I'm sitting here stuck in traffic and I think of a giant wheel and a giant wheel spinning on the road. And I sing a little part of, Proud Mary, the big wheel keep on turning.
Yeah.
And I just repeat that over and over again. It's like a mantra. And you know what? It seems to me like the traffic breaks up. You know, I've done it time after time. It's not every time, like you said, but it seems to me like the traffic breaks up. So I do it.
See,
if nothing
I think
else, keeps me in good spirits while I'm waiting. But I think
it really does.
I think that's good magic, you know, and I think that's great. And I think that's absolutely effective. I think it was Phil Hine in what was his book? Phil Hine was one of the IoT members, I believe, and he wrote a book on chaos magic. It's, you know, one of the major primer introductions, but I'm having a brain fart at the time. But they came up with a servitor called GoFlow Wolfog, which GoFlow Wolfog was the name of a character they made, which was a cat with sunglasses on a skateboard. The servitor was created with the intention to make traffic move. And so when they would get into a traffic jam, they would visualize the spirit, maybe after doing a little meditation, and just chant GoFlow Wolfog, GoFlow Wolfog. I have done this before. Sometimes it hasn't worked, but some of the worst traffic jams, or is like, I'm going to be in traffic for the next 6 hours, on at least three occasions. It was just like, there's no way that this was going to go any better. And it appears to work. Was it because of that? I can't prove it, yes or no. But it's fun to live in a universe where that is what happened. And sometimes grasping onto an effect from something like your Proud Mary spell, regardless of whether it did it or not, there is an aspect of magic in that itself.
Yeah, well, you guys let me know if there's ever magic strong enough to deal with printers, because I think that is very demiurgic. I think if I was in the show Preacher in my day in hell, I'd be like surrounded by printers that I have to fix or get to work. I'd be like,
That is genuinely hilarious you bring that up, because the way that I became an internationally known marketing and sales professional was in 2009. I joined this office printer company, hardware printers, copiers, fax machines, software as a service. In 2006, I started at the age of 21, as a graphic designer. But one thing you learn at the entry level of a startup company is that you will get tossed around quite a bit. So I started doing graphic design. The next thing I know, I'm mowing lawns. I'm working at the retail stores. I was refilling inkjet cartridges and toner cartridges, which is a filthy job. You're constantly breathing in tiny microplastics. Right. The way that I actually did Jason Miller's strategic sorcery course is I had been reading that and I was like, oh, I really want this. It was $150 or so at the time. And at 21, for this job, I wasn't getting paid a lot. So I did a sigil shoal. I went to my boss and I said, I want to do a presentation about chaos magic to you. And I want to see if you would agree that it could be used in marketing and sales to help close more deals. And this was a big risk, but I noticed he had a skull and a Buddha statue on his desk. And so I did the sigil stroll with the intention of getting him to pay for my 1-year subscription to Jason Miller's Strategic Sorcery course. I explained chaos magic in a nutshell to the best that I could with a PowerPoint presentation. I walked out of the room and he had the chief operating officer cut me a check for $150 on the spot.
Get out of here. That's cool.
So after doing that and starting to get, some good effects like embedding sigils in sales materials and stuff like that, I told him in 2009, we should get involved in social media. And in 2009, not a lot of companies were actually, successfully doing that, particularly in business to business. And he said, okay, you got 6 months and a budget of $0. Let's see what you can do. I came up with the concept of the Destroy Your Printer contest, in which we asked people to humorously and creatively destroy a printer in their office. And the winner for the first year would get 2 free toner cartridges for a working printer in their office and X hundreds of dollars donated to a charity of choice. It absolutely blew up. The current professor of social media at Rutgers University wrote an article on his private blog referring to it as the world's first successful B2B social media marketing campaign with a return on investment measurable in dollars. I did it for the next 5 years. The New York Times reached out to me. And after that, I started writing for trade publications all over the world. And that pretty much launched my career. And at least in the muggle job sense of my life was able to generate, a pretty comfortable lifestyle.
Very cool. Straight out of Office Space. That's for sure.
Yeah. And I always tell people this because they're like,
no paper jam. Sorry.
No, it's okay. But like I hadn't seen Office Space when I came up with the idea for that. Oh, okay. It was funny because my IT guy was like, oh, you're just ripping off Office Space. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he gave me the DVD and I was like, oh, well, no one's ever going to believe that I came up with this on my own, but that's okay. The movie's hilarious. And obviously there's some, it would appear to be having been the inspiration, but I actually hadn't seen that movie when I came up with the idea.
Oh, cool. Well, dislike for printers is in the collective unconscious. It's got to be like an archetype as powerful as the prince or the trickster or the mother.
Yeah. I mean, there's got to be an archon who specifically designed the printer in the minds of humanity just to make it an extra miserable aspect of human existence.
Yeah, doom millions of people to ignorance and continued reincarnation. So it is indeed. Ugh. Well, I think anything else you want to share with us, Nathan? Because I am more or less at the end. Tell us if there's anything else you want to share with the audience.
No, I think we've covered pretty much anything. I guess what I would say to anyone who's watching is if you're on the fence about magic, just give it a shot. Do it. It's super fun. If nothing else, the only one who can prove that it does or does not work to you is you. Worst case scenario, you'll have some fun along the way. And I just hope that everyone who's watching this got some value out of this conversation, and hopefully you're able to take bits and pieces of this and apply it to your own life to help you on your journey navigating the light and dark of this human incarnation and this present life. And hopefully I've provided some value to help you to traverse this space that we all are currently moving through.
Well said. I think you have. For those on the fence, what 3 types of magic disciplines do you recommend? Chaos magic and what else?
Chaos magic was what got me into it because, if you look up sigilization, it's very easy. You write out a statement of intent such as, I have a new car. You cross out the repeating letters and vowels. You take the remaining letters and form them into a glyph. You then charge it. You can Google how to charge a sigil. There's various ways, some more...
do that. Yeah, you don't have to mess. There's many other ways because some people get turned off like, ugh.
But yeah, I mean, sigilization is so easy. Anyone could do it. And but if you want to, if you're maybe you've been practicing for a bit and you've been on the primarily psychological or chaos magic side and haven't done any spirit work, I would highly recommend Rufus Opus's book, The Seven Spheres, which again is a modern interpretation of Johann Stratemius's system, originally entitled Drawing Spirits into Crystals. And it's working with one of the seven archangels, each of which is associated with one of the seven planets in our solar system. And I say that, and that's a, you know, Tritomius is a very, you know, he's a Catholic bishop. On the surface, it's a very Christian form of magic. I am not a Christian anymore. And, you know, I've got my own baggage that comes from that. It's Christian on the surface. It's hermetic once you pop the hood. And regardless if, you know, you got any hangups about the Christian religion, I can say that it's worth just doing the rituals and seeing what comes to you. I've had a lot of great positive experiences, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, and I would say magically as well. So above that, I mean, magic is like music, you know, like I'm the type of person who can listen to punk rock and then listen to Johnny Cash and then listen to Yes and then listen to Mozart. If you're the type of person who's like, you know, I'm punk rock and that's just it, chaos magic is probably a good one for you. If you're like, you know, all you listen to is Yes and progressive rock, you want to might look at something that's a little bit more structured, like the Golden Dawn or other forms of ceremonial and more advanced ritual magic. But
how about Elvis?
Elvis is sort of a magician in his own right. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here with Miguel, but let's be real. He really did rip off a lot of blues artists, and the blues goes back to the African drumming that also jazz comes from. So, you know, if you really trace it back to its roots, I mean, I think you can follow a lot of different things, whether music, magic, art, yada, 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 to Africa.
So Aboriginal magic.
It's all ripping off. Every magician rips off the other. It's the old saying, good artists borrow, great artists steal.
Yeah.
I'm working on David Bowie. David Bowie's far worse than Elvis. And he was so open and in your face, like, I'm going to rip you off and I don't care. So that's what they do. This is a trickster magic, trickster vibe. They're thieves, the Joker and the thief.
Yeah.
So
smooth jazz would be marketing then?
Well, anytime I had Kenny G, anytime I, you know, I'd be calling a client or a prospect and I was on hold, it was always smooth jazz, which as someone who temporarily went to school for music, I got to say, you know, some of those smooth jazz guitarists, bassists and horn players, they're really talented.
You bet.
Awesome. And where can people find out more about you? Where do you want to send them? I'll have something on the show notes, but let us know here what your Death Star base of operation is.
I mean, my main website that has a little bit of everything. It's got my books. It's got some video projects I've done, my art, and case studies about my work, both mundane and magically. It's on my website. It has kind of a long URL that's, I'm not going to try to have everybody jot it down, but if you just Google my name, Nathan Doobie, Wix, W-I-X, it will be the first organic Google result that comes up. It says Nathan.
It's on the show notes. Yeah, for those of you, check out the show notes, whether you're on YouTube, Rockfin, or your iTunes or Spotify. I have it there. Yeah, Nathan has a lot of great books, whether you want the marketing, his interviews. He's got a lot of good stuff that you'll find something for you, and people can reach out to you too.
Yeah. And I mean, as far as the magic stuff goes, Interview with the Magus, you know, I interviewed, like, I want to say around 60 of the top practicing magicians in the world and other psychonauts and alternative seekers like Miguel, Mitch Horowitz, and just a whole slew of people. And I ask generally everyone the same questions so that you can compare one person's responses to another, particularly those who are very, you know, intense in their opinions and completely disagree with person A, B, and C. It really helps. Right. It helped me going through the process to kind of like be like, okay, it's interesting to see where these people are disagreeing, where they're agreeing, and use that to sort of dig deeper into the collective unconscious as far as these topics are concerned. But I would just send them to my website. I have a YouTube page, Dubious Monk's Thought Portal. There's not a ton of videos. It's a new passion project. I'm not pushing extremely hard on it. I'm trying to generate content on a regular basis, generally short form content, 5 to 15 minutes tops, tips and tricks for magic or discussing other spiritual topics, hypnagogia, lucid dreaming, astral projection, that sort of thing.
Good deal. Well, good luck with that. Well, we are at the end. Good conversations in the chat. I know I enjoyed it. I hope you did too, whether you're here live or listening some video platform or audio platform, as I always put it out the next day for these live shows. But yeah, Vance, thanks for keeping us company and being a smooth operator, as Chardet would say.
Yes. Yeah, we had good chat tonight, and great to hear you, Nathan, and a lot of good stuff. Loved your thing about forgiveness is the opposite of hell. That was very good insight. Indeed. I'll always remember that.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was a pleasure to be here talking to both of you. I love you guys, and I wish you all the best on your next episodes, and I will be tuning in as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. And
thank you very much.
Yeah. A hunk of burning gnosis tonight, or as I like keep saying, no confession, no religion, don't believe in modern love. So that's it, guys. Well, everybody have a good rest of your Mars day, and we will be talking to you soon. As I always say, write your own gospel, live your own myth, because that's what you're here for. Take care, everybody.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. People always say it's good to unwind, but that's easier said than done. The exception, Chumba Casino. They actually make it easier done than said, or at least the same. Chumba Casino is an online social casino with hundreds of casino-style games like slots and blackjack. Play for fun. Play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Sign up now and collect your free welcome bonus at chumbacasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.